Climate is a theme. It's not a sector. Climate is cross-cutting across every sector of our economy. And decarbonization and energy security are frames that we use to understand the status quo today. That makes it hard to say that there's one pathway for business to go from seed to Series A to Series B. And these are the metrics or milestones that we're going to apply across the board. We were talking a little bit earlier about the milestone-based approaches that folks need to take. To some degree, those need to be bespoke to the individual company while taking into account similar businesses either in that particular sector or that have similar asset intensity and R&D profiles. That makes it more complicated, but also makes it more fun.
Welcome to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm your host, Jake Kapoor, general partner of VSC Ventures and co-host of Climb. Every week on this show, I speak with investors, founders, and industry experts who are building and scaling companies that are going to change the future of the climate transition. Today on the show, I am thrilled to have Ian Samuels, who is the founder and managing partner of New System Ventures, a climate tech investment firm that takes a systems-led approach to identifying transformative climate solutions to back or build from inception to Series B. Lots to cover there, Ian, so we're going to dive into that. But I want to share that you're a seasoned investor and operator with over 15 years of experience across investing, climate finance policy, technology, incubation, and partnership. So I'm thrilled to dive in to all of that, as well as this general theme of capital efficiency across climate tech startups.
Wonderful.
We'll start with that by just saying thank you for joining me on the show.
No, this is fantastic. I'm so excited to be following a long lineage of really thoughtful and impactful investors, operators, and so many others through the ecosystem.
It's very, very kind of you to say. It's hopefully the community we're building here on this show, and I hope that resonates for our audience as much as it has for you. Maybe let's start with your background, then we'll kind of dive right in. Your background ranges from working as a policy advisor and in the U.S. Treasury Department to investing at all levels of the capital stack. Let's talk about that government experience. How does that inform the way you think about climate investing and climate technology today?
Absolutely. So just to give our listeners a little bit of context, I started my career in finance at Blackstone. And then in 2009, during the financial crisis, I went down to Washington, D.C. to join the U.S. Treasury Department, initially on the financial crisis response team, which was a little SWAT team that Secretary Geithner had put together to help bring financial markets perspectives to firefighting key issues that we were facing in 2009. So I thought I was going to be down in DC for 6 months doing that. I ended up working in DC at the Treasury Department for 4 years.
Wow.
And pretty quickly found a bunch of other challenges where markets and finance perspectives could add a lot of value to broader public policy challenges. And one of the biggest ones was what I call clean finance or clean tech was originally what people were calling it, which included the Department of Energy Loan Program Office, as well as the cash grant in lieu of tax credit for the investment production tax credits, which were some of the main tax credits for renewable energy finance.
This is back in 2009.
Correct, 2009, 2010. Yeah. Those programs, with some modifications, changes, learnings, are two of the key levers that were in the Inflation Reduction Act to help support climate finance. Yeah. And so it's a little bit back to the future. But a lot of those efforts saw real challenges. And we have learnings from them that I think we're still recovering from, such as the loan that defaulted to Solyndra, as well as things that were really turbocharging, like these tax credits, which we can talk more about.
Yeah.
So those were some of the experiences I had. Some of the core learnings I had were how important taking into consideration the environment, the policy environment, the political environment that you are operating in as a company, and whether or not that provides you headwinds or tailwinds, and then how investors need to take that into account. So a lot of investors were banking on that there was going to be a price on carbon enacted during the Obama administration. That famously and disappointingly didn't pass the Senate at the beginning of the Obama administration. And so instead, there were a number of efforts to back early stage climate businesses, we called them clean tech businesses at that point, that ultimately failed or that went through, you know, a 15-year version of the Gartner hype cycle, going from, you know, peak excitement through a long trough of disillusionment to now a more productive plateau, But in some cases, that took 15 years and careers were, if not ended, they were stalled because of it. Firms stalled out. Companies went out of business. And so there were a lot of challenges associated with that.
Yeah, and hundreds of millions of dollars raised as well, which, you know, maybe didn't result in the venture outcomes that any of these firms were hoping for, even if the companies themselves found a steady state of
exactly.
You know, business there.
Exactly. And yeah. So I think there are a lot of learnings for me as a professional.
Yeah.
There are a lot of learnings for me as an investor or counselor to early stage entrepreneurs. And there are a lot of learnings from a macro environment as well as to how we need to finance climate businesses, startups, either that are software businesses or those that are more capital intensive, deep tech businesses that have a lot of both innovation ahead of them, but also building, scaling capital intensity ahead of them that are looking for capital both from private sources like venture or ultimately project finance, as well as from the public sector in the form of grants, loans, tax credits, and the like.
Yeah, I want to make sure we leave plenty of time to dive into that, but just so folks have some more context, when I said you've worked across all stages of the capital stack, I meant it. You know, Sidewalk Labs and Sidewalk Infrastructure Partners, and I want to dig into the difference there, as well as, was it NYCA Partners?
Yes.
Which is a fintech firm, and then Centerbridge. You know, how is working across the capital stack inform the kind of fund you want to build today and moreover, the kind of fund that the climate environment needs?
Absolutely. So just to give our listeners a little bit of context. So I left Treasury and one of the main things I did right after leaving Treasury, I was doing three things at once, was helping Hans Morris, who'd been the president of Visa, a partner at General Atlantic, and just an incredibly thoughtful and effective human being, start NYCA Partners, which is a fintech venture fund. It's still around today. They're around $1 billion of AUM on fund four to provide early stage venture capital to financial services companies. Yeah. And frankly, when I had left Treasury in 2013, there was two things I had worked on in my career, fintech and financial services and climate.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot to do professionally in climate in 2013. It was, you know, which was disappointing. And so I pointed my efforts in towards financial services, helped start, which is the first time I also helped build a financial services investment platform.
Yep.
This is now the third time I'm doing that. We can talk a little bit more about that. And in the context of NYCA, we were doing really early stage investing. So invested in seed rounds, invested in Series B rounds and so forth. I then went and spent 5 years at Centerbridge Partners. Centerbridge is a private equity and credit complex. And so in that context, I was investing in some of the oldest and most mature businesses up and down the capital structure.
These are like multi-hundred million dollar ticket sizes, right?
Or, often, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that included, you know, a $600 million loan to an ATM manufacturer.
Yeah.
It included buying a, investing in and having control over multi-billion dollar companies using several hundred million dollars of equity at a time.
Yeah.
And that, I would say, you know, I'm so grateful to my colleagues at Centerbridge, many of whom I'd worked with at Treasury and or at Blackstone. That was, you know, investing finishing school. We had to look at a range of opportunities, evaluate the risk-adjusted return and determine, do I want to invest in this instrument, in this business at this price?
Yep.
In public markets and private markets. And so that discipline is really helpful in the fight for a more sustainable energy and climate transition. Because even when we're investing at the earliest stages of a company, particularly if there's capital intensity associated with it, so particularly if they need to go build something in the physical world, atoms, not bits, for these companies to be as successful as possible, there's both an underwriting process that we go through internally at New System Ventures, and we can talk a little bit more about our underwriting process, where we evaluate, can this company achieve attractive unit economics? Can it be competitive against the alternatives? And Sometimes that's a very discrete set of alternatives. Sometimes in the case of decarbonization of trucking, you're looking at electrification, you're looking at hydrogen, you're looking at sustainable fuels, you're looking at putting wireless power transmitters in the highways. There's so many different alternatives that could be used. And will this solution ultimately be able, if it needs to be project financed or if it needs to be financed in some other structure using something other than early stage venture equity, can the company get there? Or what help do we think we need to give the company to get there? And is that within our power?
Yeah, let's dive in on that a little bit, because I, you know, whenever I hear the zeitgeist of the moment, right, which today is capital efficiency, we've had several guests on this couch just like you talk about climate tech, deep tech companies need to be building capital efficiently, they need to be thinking capital efficiently. And I think generally that's good advice, but then when you look at some of the projects that we get pitched, and I say projects, because sometimes they really are, they haven't even made it out of lab scale yet. You know, we're talking about microbiomes taking down copper, or we're talking about a new kind of battery chemistry. Is this idea of capital efficiency just because of the current capital moment that we're in today, or is this really evergreen advice for founders building in deep tech?
I think you can very rarely go wrong by being capital efficient. There are asterisks that I'll share. But having now lived through multiple cycles, the 1999-2000.com boom and bust, the 2007-2008 great financial crisis, and then whatever we're calling COVID, its aftermath, and then the normalization.
Oh, SERP era.
Exactly. In each of those cases, there have been companies that have been able to seize, carpe diem, seize the moment, raise an enormous amount of capital, gain scale, and become dominant in their respective niche or industry. But for every example like that, there are countless more companies that puttered that money away if they were able to raise it from over-exuberant investors, and would have probably been better taking a more measured approach and being more capital efficient. Because in any state of the world, the founders will own more of the company, the investors will see higher returns, and frankly, the company will be better set up for success if it has established as part of its ethos, as part of its DNA from the beginning. And I've seen companies that were on a really good track that got over their skis, overhired, tried shipping product before it was ready, doing like, you know, there's so many different mistakes that one can make when trying to hyperscale. So just to take it back a moment, the era of, for the moment at least, free money, we can blame that on interest rates, we can blame that on a lot of exuberance in late stage venture and the public markets, think SPACs. Regardless, that era is done and dusted, at least for the foreseeable future. And so the world we live in today and the world that we counsel founders that we meet with, founders that we invest in, other companies or ecosystem that we want to support, is to maniacally focus on capital efficiency while embracing capital intensity. And that's a dichotomy that is important to unpack for a moment.
Let's do it.
So there's some investors, and there's been a lot of back and forth, I suppose, on Twitter or LinkedIn, whatnot, about you know, how SaaS investors, you know, taking pot shots at SaaS investors by the deep tech community, and then vice versa. I would say everyone plays an important role, but to effectuate the amount of change that we want to get 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030, we need to change a lot fast. And we need a lot of investors who are comfortable investing in atoms, not just bits.
Yeah.
Atoms play an incredibly important role in our economy, whether it's the cars we drive, the power we're consuming today, you know, the cups we have in front of us. all of these things need to transition to more sustainable alternatives. And there's so many incredible inventors, entrepreneurs, you know, product folks, et cetera, that have brilliant visions of how we can do that. And all of those require capital in various forms. But instead of asking ourselves, hey, if we raised $1 billion, $2 billion, how quickly could we go? I think we need to be asking ourselves, how do we create a set of structured milestones that unlock additional capital that the community, the founders are really clear about and they're measuring themselves to, that the community generally is aligned with? And there's always debates about what is a Series A company versus a Series B company.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was gonna jump in there. This is all well and good if I'm a founder, right? And I'm like, yeah, no, Ian's got a great point. Raise only as much as you need for the milestone. The milestone they told me when I raised my seed round was 2 million ARR and X number of pilots. And then I hit 2 million ARR. I got X number of pilots. And then I went back to those Series A investors and they said, actually, sorry, threshold for success is now 3 million. And I have founders like that in my portfolio. I can sense their frustration when they say, I did everything I was supposed to do and the capital markets changed under me. So I know one of your ethos or systems as you evaluate these companies is thinking about their readiness for downstream capital. How do you assess that? And then how do you adapt when the capital markets change around you or around your founders?
Yes. Listen, this is an important, timely, and really hard question to answer. Maybe I should start by explaining and describing our systems level research process.
Sure.
So that that this is then put in context a little bit more. I then want to come back to a little bit more around how to think about milestone setting, because I think this is important to exercise, and then how to give yourself enough buffer to raise more money than you think you need. Everything takes twice as long and costs twice as much, whether or not you're building a house or you're pursuing a set of milestones. Not always the case, but good rule of thumb. And how to under-promise, over-deliver against them, and how to canvas the market to make sure that one has a good sense of where the market is and maybe where it's going in order to set companies up for success. So first, New System Ventures, as the name suggests, we take a systems-led approach to decarbonization of key sectors of the economy. What does that mean in practice? So we start by understanding the status quo of a particular system. Ones that we're looking at today include 24/7 carbon-free energy, which is a combination. The three pillars of the stool there are pairing intermittent renewable solar wind with long-duration energy storage, be it thermal or electrical. Second pillar is baseload clean, firm, ideally dispatchable baseload power. That's a lot of words altogether. What does that mean? That means that you can produce clean power throughout the day, regardless of if the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. And ideally, you can throttle that up or down in order to respond to grid conditions. Examples of those include hydro, fusion, fission, geothermal, and then there's some other out-of-this-world ideas like space-based solar. And then the third pillar is a more transactive energy grid that better pairs the supply and demand of electrons on a temporal and geographic basis. Mm. And so geographic includes things like transmission lines. Temporal includes providing price signals to consumers and businesses in order to try to shift their demand throughout the day. In the most basic sense, run your dishwasher at a different time of the day or charge your electric vehicle at a different time of the day. And there are a number of companies working on virtual power plant or distributed energy resource management solutions for that. So that's our one of our key focus systems in power and energy. Within mobility, we're spending a lot of time on logistics decarbonization, particularly heavy-duty trucking and then mode shift, things like rail, sea, air, and the like. And I mentioned a little bit earlier some of the opportunities and challenges that arise when you're looking at such a hard-to-decarbonize part of the economy, meaning there are a lot of different options, all of which have great things about them and drawbacks.
Yeah.
And have complexity because you're looking at a chicken and the egg problem here. Meaning you need to build the trucks and the infrastructure to support those trucks simultaneously.
Yep.
So if you have a bunch of electric trucks, you need somewhere to charge them. Sometimes it's easy because you're just driving the truck back and forth from one place to another, and you can put EV chargers at one or both of those destination and arrival points. However, if you're driving a truck across the country, you need to think about the infrastructure required at truck stops all across the country. Yep. And that becomes a lot more complicated for reasons that if, you know, we could explore
later.
Well,
if there are not enough EV trucks, for example, why would I invest in putting a charging infrastructure? And
precisely.
If I don't have charging infrastructure, why would I ever invest in doing an EV trucking fleet?
The perennial chicken and egg
yes.
problem. And so there are a lot of folks that are thinking about different ways of fixing this. And then going back to a policy perspective, there's now billions of dollars that the federal government is deploying to get EV chargers on roads.
Yeah.
Initially more for passenger vehicles than for heavy duty vehicles, but that's going to continue to evolve. And so the policy tailwinds here are really important, and headwinds in considering which solutions are more likely to work and which ones are more challenged.
Yeah.
But it also requires going out and talking to incumbents. That's everyone from the truck OEMs to the large fleet operators to some of the biggest companies in the world that move things around. And then imagining what could the world look like 5, 10, 30 years from now. And then working backwards from that.
How is that different? So I appreciate the overview of the systems led, and we'll come back to the conversation on capital efficiency. You know, we spend time with a lot of co-investors, as I'm sure do you. How does your systems-led approach differ or contrast with what you see our peers doing? Why did it feel like I needed to take a different approach as I build this fund?
There's so many great ideas coming at us every day from talented, impressive founders, technologists, scientists, and the like. And in order for us to have the conviction necessary to go on a 10-year journey with a team and a technology and have the conviction to help see it through, it's much easier for us to do that if we've done this research process. We've come up with a hypothesis as to where is the world going, either discreetly or on a probabilistic basis, and then gone out and found companies in parts of the value chain that we think have the potential for venture scale returns, and then compared what they're doing to our hypothesis.
Hmm.
What happens then? Sometimes we'll find an incredible company that matches our priors. Sometimes we'll go talk to the 10 companies doing X and we'll say, hey, we thought X should look like this. It turns out we've met this incredible team. They think X should actually look a little bit more like XY. And they've convinced us that this is the right path and we're going to go on this journey with them against that. Other times we'll say, hey, we thought this was a venture scale opportunity. We've gone and met a bunch of really talented people, but we still have questions about whether or not this is a venture business or this is a really great, you know, at scale business that a middle market private equity firm should be backing.
Yeah.
Or sometimes we'll say, we're really not sure about the unit economics yet. We're going to wait. And one of the reasons why our waterfront goes from seed to series B, and sometimes a little bit before, sometimes a little bit after, is we want to be able to cover enough waterfront that when we find the solution that we think solves a problem that we're trying to solve, that we have the mandate to go and back it and support it. And that's a little bit of the frame around our process. Yeah. And then very occasionally, we will see white space. We'll see people, individuals that are really motivated against this problem, or we'll see a great technology, but there's nobody who's actually solved this problem and built in it. And then we'll have the hard question of asking ourselves of, should we go and help conceive of this and bring it to life ourselves.
It's this idea of a prepared mind in a sense, right? So maybe if I'm understanding you correctly, what differentiates kind of your approach is starting with the research and the thesis and a prepared mind, but keeping the flexibility when you meet a founder that challenges some of the assumptions that you've found to say, okay, maybe we haven't looked at it this way. And now let's spend time with this founder. Whereas, again, you know, I've been in venture coming up on a decade now. A lot of this is sometimes done by kismet, right? You meet a founder at an event, somebody refers their ex-college roommate who's building a battery tech company, and you're like, okay, well, I have to get very quickly up to speed on how you're building this market, yep, your customers. It can feel challenging sometimes. And look, I've had success doing that in the past. And there's times where no amount of research is ever enough, because you got to make a decision in, let's say, 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
Exactly.
And that is really not enough time to get up to speed on a technology you don't know.
And so we want to go into these conversations having done the market work, having done a lot of the landscaping work, having a fairly clear set of pathways as we understand as to how the world's going to go from where it is today, where we think it's going to go. And there's always a certain amount of je ne sais quoi in all of this.
Yeah.
But we think we're going to be able to be on our front foot when meeting founders, doing things specifically that we're already have spent a lot of time thinking about. And it lets us focus our time, energy, attention in the areas that at any given moment in time we're most excited about and prepared to invest in, as opposed to the amount of research we do at the front end in an industry, the competitive landscape and so forth. It's a lot to do if we're starting from a more opportunistic introduction to a founder. We have done it before, but it requires a pretty large amount of sprinting and preparation on our end to then get to the finish line as quickly as we would like to in any given funding round.
Yeah, you know, it makes a ton of sense. So let's come back to this conversation of the capital stack, because I think that's a really great through line for our chat today. You know, where we left off before talking about the new systems approach is evaluating these companies for downstream capital readiness, yep, and how you think about doing that in an environment where you can set milestones, but the milestones shift under you based on, you know, what the next round investor wants to do. So what are the specific ways in which you evaluate these companies, but then, you know, keep your pulse on the market?
Yep. Ultimately, there is a frame, and I think Frank Rotman from QED has said this extremely well, which is, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but effectively, the goal of a startup is to learn as much as possible with it as efficiently and quickly as possible. Mm. I mean, time and money are both costly and expensive here. And so what we are spending a lot of time thinking about are both next round milestones. So what are entry milestones, what are exit milestones, both for our round and one round in the future, as well as long-term, what is the capital structure and the capital efficiency required of the business? And does the business need to unlock other forms of capital beyond venture in order to be successful? If so, even for early stage companies, we're going to start thinking about what does this company need to do to prepare to access project finance or debt capital or whatever the case may be? And are they prepared today? If not, are they on a path themselves to being prepared? Can we help them? And we spend a lot of time thinking about what are the highest value ways we can work with the teams that we back to accelerate their progress. And so having myself, other members of our team, some of our advisors worked in project finance, in insurance and lending, in capital intensive businesses, that's an area that if it's applicable, if it's a hardware business of some kind, we spend a great deal of time. And so if I were to break that down, it's if you're raising a seed round, what do you need to do to raise your A and B rounds? And is a company orienting itself around a product roadmap, a minimum viable product plus? I know that you have a lot of strong views on MVPs, which I'd love to delve into. As well as the, you know, the commercial milestones, other milestones required that are likely going to unlock, based on either where we are today or normalized capital markets environment, additional capital from other investors, as well as potentially from ourselves as well.
Yeah. So maybe we'll chat on that comment on MVP, because I always think, you know, coming from my history as a more generalist software investor, there was very sort of clear understanding of what each round was for, right? So pre-seed, you are, you've de-risked the team, you're kind of taking a risk on the product. Seed, you have de-risked the product, you're taking a bet on the market. Series A, you've de-risked the market, you're taking a bet on scale. And by Series B, now it's, hey, how big can this get? How many markets we can open? I've done that. I've run that playbook. I've seen companies successfully execute it. And then I started investing in climate tech, in hardware, in atoms, things that don't always look like that very linear, very easy to understand path that I talked about. When there has been so much, I guess, interest in these non-dilutive sources, in grant funding, in, you know, public kind of partnerships. How do you think about that kind of linear or maybe not linear path that I talk about? And where do these alternative capital sources fit into that journey?
Absolutely. So that's a fantastic question. I would say a few things. One, climate is a theme. It's not a sector. Climate is cross-cutting across every sector of our economy, and decarbonization, energy security are frames that we use to understand the status quo today, where we believe as a society, as a country, and as a world that we need to go, and as a tailwind that is accelerating against a bunch of then smaller changes to specific economic systems or products and so forth. So that makes it hard to say that there's one pathway for a business to go from seed to Series A to Series B. And these are the metrics or milestones that we're going to apply across the board. It would nearly be impossible, particularly as you're looking at software businesses, robotics businesses, deep tech businesses, you know, across a wide spectrum. And so we're talking a little bit earlier about the milestone-based approaches that folks need to take. To some degree, those need to be bespoke to the individual company while taking into account similar businesses either in that particular sector or that have similar asset intensity and R&D profiles. That makes it more complicated, but also makes it more fun.
Can you give me an example from your portfolio where you've advised them, maybe their journey wasn't as clear cut and sort of easy to slot in, but they've been able to, you know, find their footing using maybe some of these alternative sources?
Sure. Well, so maybe just to unpack, there are an incredible amount of incentives available to companies to either do research or deployment of their solutions.
Yeah.
And so I'll give you a few examples and then talk about how is this applicable to our portfolio today. So at the earliest stages, there are programs like ARPA-E, which is a program at the Department of Energy that was started under the Obama administration as part of the Recovery Act funding, and is modeled after DARPA, which is this incredibly successful multi-decade program in the Defense Department. They are pursuing a range of grant programs against key technologies that they think are going to be transformative, often at the earlier stages, but they're building a scale-up program. On the other end of the spectrum are things like the Department of Energy Loan Program Office, led by Jigar Shah, who's doing an incredible job. But if you look at the volume of loans that they need to put out that are in their pipeline, that program is still ramping up. And that program is really going to be best for a discrete number of companies that, you know, for instance, the battery industry. They're going to do a great job helping us scale up the battery industry. For earlier stage companies that are still trying to build their first prototype or factory, the loan program office is probably not the right home for you, regardless of how encouraging Jigar's tweets or public statements have been and the like. And we have this conversation with a lot of companies that accessing a program of that scale and magnitude is often a multi-year process that requires really rigorous underwriting, planning, and et cetera, and is likely not the default solution for a first-of-a-kind type facility.
Yeah.
And in the middle, there are a bunch of grant programs that the Department of Energy, a lot of other programs have that may be right for your climate startup. They may not be. And we encourage folks to spend a lot of time before they bet their company on a specific program or so forth to make sure they understand, particularly if it's a application process, that they are a good applicant for the program. That they have the resources required both to apply and to meet the requirements on an ongoing basis. Because it's a lot of work to do all the reporting and so forth, as well as ultimately, if that doesn't pan out, that there are other alternatives, there are backup plans for them. And that's particularly notable in this political environment where there may be a new administration in office next year that has very different perspectives on a lot of these initiatives. And then there are broad-based programs, if you fit certain applicability criteria, you can get access to.
Hmm.
Those include the investment and production tax credits for solar, wind, but now advanced manufacturing, carbon capture, hydrogen, and a variety of other
things. Are
these
part of the IRA as well?
Yes.
They are, okay.
Some of these programs have been around for decades.
Yeah.
So going back to you know, the Carter and Reagan administrations is when the original investment and production tax credit programs were originally conceived of.
Yeah.
And they've gone through a lot of changes, modifications, addendums, and so forth. But these programs have broadly been around for decades.
Right.
But the IRA expanded them and provided a lot more certainty that they're going to be around for 10 plus years.
Hmm.
And when the Inflation Reduction Act passed, Alfred Johnson, who is a founding advisor at New System Ventures, is someone that I worked with at the Treasury Department 15 years ago, cracked open the IRA. I cracked open the IRA. And he just started getting extremely excited about how transformative it was that the Inflation Reduction Act IRA made these credits transferable.
Hmm.
Whereas historically only a small number of firms could really participate in the tax equity markets. And what does that mean? It means that smaller firms that couldn't get access to tax equity because some of the largest firms really only focused on $100 million plus transactions can now participate in a much smaller size. So if you're doing a community solar project or if you're doing much smaller initial projects that are generating production tax credits, you too can now participate in this market. And so Alfred started a company called Crux Climate that publicly launched last year, raised a seed round from Lower Carbon, from us, from a handful of other folks, and just announced a Series A from Andreessen, led by David Haber, who is the New York-based fintech GP and a longstanding friend as well.
And a neighbor of mine on the Upper West Side.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. That's on the back of this market going from effectively no volume in the first half of last year to Treasury coming out with guidance and the market being a $7 to $9 billion market in the second half of last year, potentially growing to roughly the same size as tax equity, $25 billion a piece, using round numbers by the end of, by 2025. And so this is a really interesting opportunity where this is a marketplace and supporting software and services that are enabling of climate businesses around the country.
Can we go one-on-one for a second? Because I think people have heard about carbon markets and they've heard about tax credits around carbon reduction.
Yep.
And you know, how, just to make it very sort of consumer friendly, how Taylor Swift buys these credits when she is getting on a flight from Japan to Las Vegas for the Super Bowl. So I think there's an understanding of what carbon credits are.
Yep.
These are different, though. What Crux is trading is different. So maybe just let's go 101 for our listeners on what these credits are and how they differ from maybe traditional carbon markets.
Absolutely. So carbon markets are really important. And what they're trying to do is either through government mandate or through voluntary efforts by large companies, by consumers, to purchase tons of carbon offset or removed. And there's a range of different standards here. That market is still evolving. And that's a really important market. What we're talking about right now is a little bit different, which is, at its core, the US government will pay you or reimburse you through your taxes to develop or produce specific plants or units of measure. So first, in the investment tax credit, if using rough numbers, if you spend $100 building a solar facility, you're eligible for $30 back on that as a tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
But most developers don't have $30 of taxes or $30 million of taxes, as the case may be. And so they need someone else who is a current taxpayer to utilize those tax credits. And historically, it required these very complicated tax equity transactions where a bank like JP Morgan or Bank of America was becoming a partner in your project for 5, 10 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
The primary beneficiaries of that were the service providers, the lawyers, the accountants, and so forth, because these transactions were so complicated. And so, and the market really stalled in 2008, 2009, when the available tax equity providers contracted because fewer companies were making money. Fast forward, Congress, in its wisdom, saw that these markets needed to function better. And so they created a transferability market that Crux and a handful of other folks have stepped into to make it easier for the companies or individuals with tax liabilities to go and buy the credits at a discount. So 80, 85, 90, sometimes even 92 to 95 cents on the dollar. They do that, and instead of either, you know, in April when they, or October when they pay their taxes, or on a quarterly basis when they pay their estimated taxes, they can go buy these credits. And then if they went and bought them for, you know, 90 cents of credits, they then reduce their, or paid 90 cents, they then reduce their
tax
liability by 100 in that instance.
So just to summarize, so I make sure I get it correctly, I may be a company that has nothing to do with the solar project that you're setting up in Orinda, California, but the project developer needs some money.
Yep.
The project developer knows, hey, if I do, let's say, $100 million worth of this project, because of this program, I can earn $30 million in credits. I don't have $30 million of credits to spend, but a business in Chicago that does have a large tax liability can then go and purchase, let's say, 3 million of those credits at 90 cents on the dollar, and it's still coming out on top. And
exactly.
The project developer is able to get their project financed. Everybody's able to get solar. So that's the goal of the system working correctly.
Exactly.
Okay.
And by the end of the decade, in order to hit our renewable development goals, we need roughly 1 in 5 of every dollar that companies across the United States pay in taxes to be participating in the transferable tax credit marketplace, which is really just stunning to think about.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly exciting opportunity because for the first time, sustainability teams and tax departments within big companies can partner together to turn the tax department, in the same way the energy procurement team over the last 10 or 15 years in large companies has become an important part of the sustainability story of any company, the tax department and the sustainability department can come together. And we're seeing a lot of really exciting opportunities coming out of that for companies across the country that have, as you said, have nothing to do with that particular project or have nothing to do with sustainable energy or renewable energy more generally. Yeah. So those are investment tax credits. Production tax credits, a little bit more complicated. But if you're a wind producer, if you're making batteries or a host of other things, you can get paid per unit through tax credits that you can then also either internalize or transfer to third parties as well. So First Solar, for instance, did a really large PTC trade at the end of the year, which was to a financial services technology company, which was really exciting. Just demonstrates how quickly this market's being adopted. And so Crux, Alfred, the rest of the team are at the forefront of this. And we had the privilege of being, you know, friends to them, but also conspirators to them at the early stages in helping accelerate the company's journey using some of my experience at the Treasury Department, as well as helping to bring together a world-class team of folks that are now well on their way of turning this market into the ubiquitous scaled market it needs to be.
I'm so glad that you covered this with us, because we have done 65 plus episodes of the show and we've never actually dug into the mechanical way that these IRA tax credits are applied, right? We talk about big numbers, and I think large numbers like $350 billion, they're just so impossible to grasp, right? And you're like, okay, well, $350 million in the US, $350 billion, you know, what's it on a per person basis? Doesn't make any sense. But I think when you put a tangible example like that and you say, as a company, you can reduce your tax liability and have a hand in the clean energy transition.
Absolutely.
That is very, very clear. And then to say, okay, now there are companies out there that are making it easier for you to trade on those markets as opposed to having to go through historically consultants and lawyers and things like that. I think it just makes it real for people that as a small business, as a startup, as even a mid-sized business, as a private equity firm or bank, there are ways that these folks who have nothing to do with the production of energy can actually have a hand in the energy transition. And again, to maybe double underline it, the reason this is important is the pace of change that needs to happen today, right? We are blowing through the targets that keep getting set at COP27, COP28.
Absolutely.
And yet here we are in this country talking big about big numbers in the IRA, but then I don't know. Sometimes I get concerned about how slowly we're actually moving. So I know this is a pet peeve or topic of yours, talking about the pace and why change can be scary. So maybe I'll tee you up. You know, why is change so scary, and why is it important that we embrace the pace of change when it comes to making the energy transition, the climate transition?
This is a great question. People are generally scared of change. Change is scarier when it's faster. And we need to change faster and more than we ever have before as a society. And so that is a headwind that we face as we're looking to do all of this, and something that we need to keep in mind. But on the flip side, I'm also more optimistic than ever, because we are seeing the learning curves compound so quickly. So many of the projections that we look out, and if you look at the estimates of solar capacity installations or the cost curves for solar, wind, batteries, they've all come down way faster than we originally anticipated. And so that is the offset, which is you look and you say, you can see these incredible cartoons in newspapers of people hanging from electrical distribution wires and getting electrocuted a century ago.
Yeah.
As people were getting really concerned about the rollout of the original electrical grid. But that was inevitable. And it happened way faster, happened slower than innovators wanted, but it happened way faster than people predicted. In part because it was so transformative to people's lives. It made people's lives better. It saved them time. It saved them money. And so as we can get these solutions to be better, cheaper, faster than the legacy alternatives, I'm really optimistic that we're going to see the pace of change increase and people's comfort with it and excitement with it grow as, you know, they go from having a gas oven in their home to an induction stove that is better to cook with, safer for them and their children, and ultimately much cheaper.
Yeah.
Or whatever intervention that folks have. Just to be clear, there will be many troughs of disillusionment along the way where people, markets, founders hope that we could change things incredibly fast, faster than we ever will. And when that doesn't happen, that there are going to be people that give up or say, hey, this is never going to happen. Look at with electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are still growing share really quickly. They're scaling, but they're not doing it quite as fast as people hope for. And so I think that that's a duality that we just need to remember. And remember that this is happening to everyone. And so folks who are focused on environmental justice and engaging with communities and getting them to both participate in and see the benefits that their communities will experience across the country, across the world, all of these things coming together is going to have set us up for a really exciting, next 10, 30 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to be 65 in 2050. And so I view this as, you know, generational work for me.
Yeah.
And career defining work for me. And I'm so excited to be on this journey with folks such as yourself who are not just acting and doing, but helping to tell and amplify the stories of so many incredible folks. And so thank you for having me on. I'm so grateful for this privilege.
Well, I'm really very kind of you to say, and very touched by that. You know, I think about messaging and storytelling being such an important part of this transition, not just from a business sense, but from the sense of identity, right? And one of the stories I find myself quoting to people quite often is this great article I read in Financial Times last year about Montana and Wyoming cattle ranchers that actually were making three times as much by putting wind farms on their acreage. But so much of their identity was tied to being cattle ranchers that they still keep 200 heads of cattle, even though that's actually a loss leader for them. They lose money on the cattle, but so much of their identity is tied to being a third generation rancher when all of the money is actually coming from the energy transition. That is a story that is not about business. That's a story about identity and personality. Yep. And how you speak to an individual in that sense. And I mean, we're talking Montana and Wyoming, we're talking the reddest of red, you know, countries or parts of the country, excuse me. And yet they are taking the energy transition, however begrudgingly. Mm-hmm. So I think to me, what that means is more of these stories need to be told, more examples like Crux Climate need to be shared where, you know, people that don't think they have a hand to play in this, whether politically or just because, hey, I'm not in this sector, actually understand that they do. And it is a part of what they're doing. So you know, I'll close with you where I love to close with a lot of our guests. And you started touching on some of this already. But, you know, when I think about the pace of change needed, when I think about the scale of change needed, it can be easy to get sucked into the doom and gloom. How do you stay hopeful and optimistic about the work that needs to be done and technology's role in helping advance climate transition?
You know, it's a really important question. There are days when you open up Twitter X or you read headlines around the pace of warming or the doomsday glacier or whatever the case may be. And you see individual companies that are struggling, and those are hard moments or days. On the other hand, if we look at the arc of where we were 10, 15 years ago, Solar wind are now some of the cheapest resources to put on the grid. They're winning. And that's because of learning curves, that we went from something that was expensive to something that continuously became cheaper and better, and provides an important component of our economy. And so I am hopeful and optimistic that through innovation and scaling, that we will be able to solve many, if not all, of the challenges that we face as a society from a climate perspective in the coming decades, or find workarounds where we can't solve that particular problem using, you know, carbon capture and credits as an example for the hard to abate components, such that we can live in a cleaner, more secure from a trade perspective, more secure from an energy security perspective, and better world 5 years from now than we do today, 10 years from now than we did then, and ultimately over the coming decades, leave the world in a much better place and a sustainable place from where we found it. And so you and I are at the front end of the wedge there. But what I'm trying to do is set so many of our companies up for success to be the next companies that can scale, benefit from massive learning curves, and become ubiquitous in deploying the solutions that they have for their specific end market. So
yeah,
that's what drives me, excites me, motivates me, and I keep in the back of my mind on good days and bad days.
Yeah. Well, that was beautifully said. And I think one of the things that you really said that resonated with me was climate is not a sector, it's a theme. It is touching everything that we are experiencing in our lives today. And it's a generational challenge. It is a important defining challenge. And from everything that you've done and shared today, I know that you and the new systems team are certainly up to the task. So thank you again, Ian, for joining me and for sharing your lessons and experiences across the climate stack, and we'll hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Climb by VSE. Thank you so much for watching and listening. My thanks to my guest, Ian Samuels from New System Ventures, for joining me and sharing his perspective today. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to every episode of Climb? Head on over to YouTube, where we do full episodes every Wednesday and clips every single day. You could scroll for hours, I swear. Also, if you like this episode, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and Spotify. And if you love this episode, please recommend a guest to us. We'd love to have them on the show. Well, that's all for now. Thank you so much for watching Climb by VSC. We'll see you next week.